from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 proudly present The Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of The Killer Bees.
Now bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Ooh, what up, H-Town? Hey, how we doing?
He's Blank, I'm Branham. Brendan, behind the glass, it is a Wednesday edition of The Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. I am sorry that I missed the anniversary
Look who's
show.
Back. Jeremy's back.
Yeah.
Back again.
That's right.
Look
All of those
back.
Things.
Look who's back. You okay?
I'm good. Yeah, everything's good.
Because you actually had so much animosity that you didn't want to be a part of the anniversary show, and now you.
It was just too emotional for me.
Oh.
It was too emotional for me to be a part of that day. It means too much to me. You, Brendan, the Hive. It was just. It was all too much to handle. It was all very, very too much. Very too much. It was all too much to take. I got to admit, but I do hate that I missed it. It's been a good year.
It's been a great year. But was it harder to take that or these last two Astros games?
Oh, you can't worry about mid-August baseball. You can't worry about mid-August baseball.
Really?
Are you kidding me? I have a new scope. I have a new view on life.
Evidently you do, because this is not something that I was expecting to hear from
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I got a new view on life. Who cares about mid-August baseball?
Which
right?
was tougher to take, last night or the night before?
Because
we didn't talk to you after the Urquidy stuff.
The night before. The night before. Yesterday was like, look... yesterday was hard to take because you have Verlander on the mound, you have a 2-run lead, and then you give it up. You give it up. It was, that was a hard one to take. There wasn't, that to me yesterday, though, was like a tip your cap game. Like, the Astros didn't really do anything wrong. Would you have liked better run production? Sure. You would always like more runs. Would you have wished that Jose Altuve wasn't picked off second base? Sure.
Oh, man.
But that stuff happens, you know, in baseball. Jose Altuve is prone to base running blunders. So yesterday was a tip the cap game. They have a late rally, they squeak one out at the end, tip your cap. The one on Monday was frustrating because you feel like whatever side of the argument that you're on, you feel like you gave that one away.
Yeah, you can look at two nights ago and you can point a finger squarely at Dusty. You can look at Montero. You can look a lot of different ways. Last night, and I went back and watched it a couple of times, the same exact pitch that JV threw to start the at-bat, which was a slider that dove down and in that was essentially unhittable, just sat up in the zone in a 1-2 count. And he got hit. And, you know, yeah, you can say Neris didn't have his A game. It's just the one thing that I think that you're looking at, which is why I was always concerned with the bullpen all year, but now it's a different reason to be concerned with the bullpen. Your starters have been so good. They've been going so deep into games that they aren't getting a lot of work. That's why for Dusty to say what he did the day before about who to go to and go to a guy that had pitched the day before and not pitched well when he had so many options – was a little bit head-scratching to me because these guys almost feel like they're going to start getting a little rusty because the starters have been doing so much. But that was just an unfortunate set of circumstances last night because it's parlayed with what happened the night before. You get people that are, you know, kind of losing their minds a little bit.
Oh,
but it's just one of those
it's
things.
Awesome.
It's a great two-game winning streak for the White Sox when they need it. The Astros, really, there's nothing lost in the process. It's just... those are tough losses to take.
I didn't mind Montero two nights ago, honestly. I kind of like that Dusty goes back.
Really?
I think that it's, especially in mid-August, I think it is a good thing to go with a struggling arm back-to-back to see what they got. Like, we saw it with Presley. Remember when Presley got shelled in the Yankee series and he blew the save in game one, and then all of a sudden he's back out there the very next day. We're like, oh, wow, okay. And was Nels. And it started, I believe that was the first of what sparked, like, what was it, 29, 30 innings or 30 batters in a row?
Was,
he went 30 straight, retired. So I don't hate the idea of let me go to a struggling arm to see what the bounce back looks like. I think that there is some psychology there. There's more in that inning that not really worth rehashing.
See, but I'll play
flip
side of the fact
that
with the amount of pitches thrown and the fact that he went through what he went through, and that was two outings in a row at the time where he was not good. The fact that you didn't have to throw him right back out there until his arm was ready, and then maybe he has that, you know, that plus-plus dominant fastball again with more control on it, and then maybe there's a better chance for him to succeed. But I just thought, you know, it was funny, and ironically, Brendan and I were talking about it yesterday, the fact that Dusty made reference to the fact, once again, a Dustyism, he made reference to the fact that, you know, he couldn't use Stanek because he used him the day before and didn't realize he didn't use him the day before.
Did he say that?
Yes. I mean, these are the kind of things when you stack and rack all the Dustyisms, you just shake your head, scratch your temple, and go, the hell is he talking about?
See, those are the things, too. Like, you can maybe make some sense and, like, rationalize some of the decisions, but then whenever you hear the logic, you're like, what?
Yeah.
What was that?
And again, if it was just one time, like the All-Star game, that's just one time? Yeah. No. Then it's the trade on national TV with Vasquez and with Mancini and not knowing either guy. And then it's, you know, the Stanek moment. There's all these other moments and you're just going, wow, like, is this for real?
Yeah. It hurts your head a little bit. I actually took some positivity from yesterday's game,
okay,
believe it or not. I know that another blown lead stinks. You hate to see that. But one thing that the Astros have been very good at over the last 5-6 years, this golden era of Houston Astro baseball, is that they've shown an ability to hit good pitching. That they've shown an ability to beat good pitchers, especially in games that matter. We see it in the playoffs a lot. The Astros approach, really, since 2017, they used to be a lot of swing and miss prior to 2017. Then they started making more contact. They started taking more pitches. They started to make it more difficult for starting pitching. And I look at Dylan Cease, who you can make the case is the second best pitcher in the American League. If he's not second, he's in the top three. I think Verlander, Cease, McClanahan are the top three in the American League right now. And Gerrit Cole probably still deserves to be in the chat, still deserves to be in the conversation. But watching the Astros approach on Dylan Cease yesterday, the fact that they get three runs off of one of the very best pitchers in all of the American League, I think it was the first time he's given up more than two runs, like, basically all year,
in 14
right?
games, yeah.
So the fact that they scored three runs on him in five innings, they forced him, they scratched six hits against him. He walked three. They forced him to exit the game in the fifth inning. That's the Astro playoff team, playoff offense that I've become accustomed to, that they make life living hell for the opposing starting pitcher, no matter who it is on planet Earth.
You know, as much as their offense is getting a lot of heat right now about the run production per game and all the things where their quote-unquote numbers are down,
mm-hmm.
the fact is that there's no denying the talent in this lineup. And the fact that, you know, you can go from portions of the season and say, well, early on you didn't have Gurriel and you didn't have Bregman. And then, you know, now you can say Bregman's on fire, but now, you know, Yordan is not exactly, you know, lighting it up.
Uh-huh.
And Peña has taken a step back. That's the beauty of how much talent's in this lineup. When some guys are scuffling, the other guys are picking it up and taking it to another level. And even a guy like Diaz, unfortunately, he gets hurt last night. But what he's done over the last 4 weeks has just been so impressive and just adds another effective bat to the lineup to where you go, you can do this analytically and say they're not scoring as many runs as this team or that team. But when you watch them when they play in the games that matter against pitchers, like you mentioned, are good, they're never going to shy away or underachieve. This is a team that is capable at any given time of putting a crooked number on you and put it on a hurry. That's what pissed me off about ESPN last night. After the game, the headline was, in the anticipated matchup between Cease and Verlander, neither guy really performed, and, you know, it was a White Sox win late. I was like, take away that seventh inning from Verlander, and he was dealing after the first inning.
Yeah, I thought he was awesome. I saw some of that, too. Like, and look, how you finish matters, and it's the body of work. Three runs over seven innings is not great. It's not a great start, especially on Verlander's standards, right?
Right.
He's made this Cy Young standard, but it wasn't a poorly pitched game from a Verlander perspective. It just got away from him there a little bit late in the seventh. White Sox hanging the crooked number, tying it up, and then winning into the eighth off of Hector Neris, basically. But I took some positivity out of the Astros' approach against Dylan Cease. The negativity with the Astros' offense is the four innings after that and couldn't scratch anything against the White Sox bullpen.
Cueto did it the night before, too.
Cueto was, I mean, cruising.
They got Cueto early with the two spot, and then he absolutely was mowing them down.
So you'd like to see a little bit foot on the gas, especially once you go to the bullpen. Like, when Dylan Cease leaves the game in the fifth, one of the best pitchers in the entire American League, and again, very positive that the way that they handled Cease, the approach, forcing the pitch count up, scratching three runs off one of the very best over five innings of work. Huge positive. It reminds me of the Astros in clutch moments. But then to allow the next four innings to go by against the bullpen, once you've achieved by taking Cease out of the game, frustrating there. Certainly stinks that you've lost back-to-back games the way that you've done it. The fact that you've lost leads late in the game when it felt like you could have won either one. To me, the most interesting thing from yesterday's game, though, like, I know that there was drama between Verlander and Cease. I know that the Astros blew the late lead. To me, was the mound visit between Maldonado, Verlander, and then Maldi calling Miller out there to have the conversation, too. That was interesting.
But to me, I went back and watched that again, too. I didn't think it was as big a deal as everybody's making it. And I thought, you know what, again, until you know the details, and maybe we never will, but I thought that was one of those things about what certain pitches to pitch to a certain hitter, and then calling the pitching coach out to say, hey, what's the scouting report say? because they're probably trying to remember what they had in the meeting about, you know, certain hitters. And I thought it was more much to do about nothing, and they wanted to get the right scouting report down for the hitter they were about to face.
It was weird that it was like it was animated, but it didn't look like anybody was mad.
No, it didn't look like anybody was mad at all.
But then Miller gets out there and he's kind of yelling.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's because in the past he knows that it was basically he was called out, like that Verlander put him in his place and told him to turn around and go home.
That was fascinating.
But it was bizarre.
It was to me that was the most entertaining part of the game, if I'm being honest. Here was Verlander after the game when asked about the mound visit between Maldonado and everybody else.
Just going over the report.
Okay.
Just going to report on him. That's it.
Got nothing from Verlander.
That's what I went back to look at too. Like I understand when you got to catch when you got the mask on, your head might bob a little bit or it looks like. But I kept looking just to see the facial expressions in the cage and everything of all the guys. And the only one that looked heated was Miller.
Yeah.
When Miller came out, he looked like, you know, I'm going to put this to rest. You know, I'm going to tell you how, because again, he knows what the body language looked like the last time he and Verlander had a mound visit that everybody remembers. It almost was like he was trying to do that, but the pitcher and the catcher looked fine.
It was so weird because they were animated and they were loud, but none of them looked mad.
Right, I agree.
It was the weirdest thing. 713-780-ESPN. Maybe they were arguing about which Chicago pizza is the best. What do you think Maldonado and Verlander were discussing? 713-780-ESPN. Astros blowing a lead for the second time in a row. Does it make you feel any differently about the Astros? 713-780-3776. We're on Twitch, twitch.tv/ESPN975. He's at Pac-Man Joel on Twitter. I'm at Jeremy Branham. Are the Yankees struggles a consolation to these back-to-back losses, though? It's Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Hey, before we go to the break, tell you about my good friend Doc Linville. Look, I've been telling you about Doc Linville and the fact that if you guys are out there and you're experiencing hair loss or you've got thinning and you think there's nothing you can do about it, there is actually something you can do about it, and it's actually all natural with your own hair. It's not sprays and creams and foams and trying to actually cover up and hide the problem. It's actually fixing it because genetically, you're always going to have the hair on the sides and the back of your head. Even guys that go bald everywhere else can tell you that. And Doc Linville is the first one that explained it all to me. And he's the one that said, do you want your old hairline back? And I hadn't really thought about it, but then I actually had a consultation with him and his staff where I could ask questions. I could find out about the NeoGraft procedure, and I could see all the different reasons why people were flocking to Doc Linville and having this procedure done and raving about the results. You can too. As an ESPN listener, you get a free consultation with Doc Linville's office that normally costs $150, and you can ask all those questions too. All you got to do is go to 975hair.com and set up an appointment. They're going to talk to you for free. They're going to answer all your questions from financing options to the length of the actual procedure to the recovery time to the actual time to see the full results, which is normally 6 to 9 months. Or the one that got me, the 95%+ success rate of every follicle moved is going to stay. It's going to grow. It's going to be there for the rest of your life. It's phenomenal. It's fantastic. I love the procedure that I had, and I am reaping the benefits of all those great results. So is Jake. So is John. So is Fred Fowler. You could be next in line. Check them out today. Go to 975hair.com and go see my friend Doc Linville.
My name is Stephen A. Smith, and you're listening to 98.7.
Wait, what?
I said 98.7. That's my show.
Let's try this one more time, okay?
My name is Stephen A. Smith, and you're listening to 97.5 FM.
Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
What were Maldonado and Verlander talking about on the mound whenever they had a little bit of an animated, I wouldn't call it heated, I would say an animated loud discussion between the two? 713-780-ESPN. Eric the Driver says Maldi was arguing that Chicago deep dish is better than Detroit-style pizza. Realistically, though, I think they were disagreeing on how to attack the batters. What is better, in your opinion, Brendan? Because Brendan is our self-proclaimed pizza expert, although I would dispute pretty much all of his pizza takes. Are you a Chicago guy or Detroit deep style?
I enjoy both. They're my two favorite styles of pizza, but I think Detroit has it more right.
They're both deep. Detroit's just a little bit more rectangular, whereas the Chicago is a little bit deeper. I would say it's deeper, right? Chicago?
Oh, Chicago's definitely deeper. There's the other big difference is Detroit deep dish is crispy. Chicago deep dish is like a bread bowl.
You put a little bit of the cheese on the corner of the pan.
Right.
That way you get a nice little
Anybody
crisp.
Disrespect Chicago deep dish pizza, and they can kiss all of my ass.
I like both a lot. but Detroit style is better.
It's a lot of kissing they got to do.
No, not really, especially with your workout program with the super seniors. A
lot of kissing.
You've recovered from that yet?
I haven't.
Okay.
I was telling my wife about that yesterday. I was like, man, my back is still bent out of shape.
Gertrude and the Golden Girls made Jeremy feel old and sore.
I do feel old and sore.
Deep dish pizza. Deep dish Chicago deep dish pizza is the best pizza on the planet.
Pequod's. Give me Pequod's.
No, it is not. You know what I'm going to say. No. Was it Mall?
You're going Giordano's.
Giordano's, and then the other one is Ray.
I haven't done that one. I haven't done that one. So I couldn't.
Is it Mall? Ray Mall?
I don't remember. I don't know. I know what you're referencing, but I don't remember the name.
It's like Maldonado.
Something like that, yeah.
Way Maldonado.
I think it's Martin Maldonado's Pizza.
It's something like that, yeah. But yeah. I'm always a Giordano's guy. But my goodness, when you get the right crust done the right way, and then it's the deep dish with all that cheese, and especially obviously from a Wisconsin guy. Man, that's my favorite of all time.
We can see why Verlander and Maldonado were so animated and so loud about it. 5535, probably discussing why Germ E missed his one-year anniversary. I hope that they were talking about me. That'd be fantastic. Eric says, says a lot if Vasquez is catching the next Verlander start. I'll be honest with you. That was one of my immediate thoughts was who catches Verlander's next start. If it's Maldonado, all for naught, didn't matter. If it's Vasquez, I think there's maybe a little bit more to that visit than we are giving credit to.
Yeah, you know what? I was also watching the body language after the mound visit. No matter what happened, there wasn't any, like, aftermath. There wasn't a continued, you know, back and forth. Even when they walked off and even at a certain point when they were communicating before the inning was over, it seemed like that everything was cool. So I'm assuming that it was literally what – and I didn't hear that soundbite till we just played it – but I'm assuming that it was kind of like exactly what I had said to you, which was they were just trying to be clear on the scouting report because there was some uncertainty. And that's part of baseball.
I think Verlander forgot it, to be honest with you. I think that there was a disagreement. I don't even know who they were disagreeing with. Like, was it for the pinch hitter sheets or was it for the eight-hole hitter? Like, I couldn't tell, like, who even they were talking about. Because sometimes that's more reactionary than pro-action. So I don't even know if it was for the eight-hole or if it was for Sheets who was pinch hitting. I really have no idea. But I think Verlander was wrong about the scout. And that's why Maldonado was like, no, it's this. Verlander was like, no, it's this. And that's when Maldonado was like, Miller, come settle this for us. Come be our arbiter.
That's exactly what I thought it was. And I'll tell you this. The only thing that was shocking to me was, and this is something you and I have gotten into in detail in the past, which happened two nights ago, which really bothered me too. Up in the count, Astros pitchers are still, especially 0-2s, but even 1-2s, they're just making too many hittable pitches that are over the meat of the plate. Mm-hmm. But I thought, as well as he got him on the first slider down and in, if he was emptying the tank, he knew because I was watching his pitch count, and I thought he might be able to squeak one more out if he had another quick inning. But once he got deep into that inning and this was it, I thought he'd empty the tank, and if he just would have been hard fastball on the upper deck of the strike zone on the outside corner, I don't think there's any question in my mind he would have gotten a swing and miss. And it's just unfortunate that the slider didn't slide, and it sat there, and it ended up, you know, costing him a win.
He mentioned it in the postgame that he said the pitch wasn't terrible, but he would like to have it back. He said
he said
it was a little more elevated than he would have liked it. So it kind of set up in the zone. He didn't want it there. He did make very clear that he wished he wasn't up in the zone. 713-780-ESPN. What were Verlander and Maldonado talking about on the mound yesterday? 2937. Maldy was trying to discuss the Better Call Sal finale and just hasn't seen it yet. No spoilers. I am anti-spoiler. So if that was the case, I'm Team Verlander when it comes to this. 713-780-ESPN. In Fuentes on our Twitch, twitch.tv/ESPN975, because I have a new view on life. Who cares about mid-August baseball? He says, was Branham doing ayahuasca yesterday?
What?
I don't know. That's what he said. Y'all tell me what that is. That, to me, sounds like something you can get from a street vendor in Mexico City.
I think it was an attempt at what Aaron Rodgers did.
That's what I thought. Where he was throwing up and forcing himself to throw up.
I thought
up
there was a pee somewhere there.
No, this was the, this
didn't
was this,
hot, didn't
this
eat.
Was this drug that wasn't violating the drug code of the NFL.
That's right.
That kind of hallucinogen or whatever he was taking in the offseason.
He was just microdosing as long as it wasn't the full dose.
Yeah.
That's all right. I'd give it a shot. Why not?
Well, I mean, you know me. I'm done with everything off the field with that guy. Just win football games for the green and gold.
You don't like Rodgers?
I don't like all the he's a diva, he's an egomaniac. I just don't like all the antics off the field that are unnecessary. Like even dressing up like Nicolas Cage. Did you see the new thing now?
Yeah, it was good. Con Air. Did you see the new thing now? He's funny.
The new thing now is that someone, he doesn't know where it came from, Jeremy, but there's a mini bust of Nicolas Cage's head, like a Hall of Fame bust.
Yeah.
That's on the top shelf of his locker now. He's like, I don't know where it came from. I don't know what it is. But he made probably a point of bringing it down and showing it to the media.
His teammates
yesterday.
Probably gave it to him.
I thought the great thing was, and I don't know how he gets away with it, but and you, I don't, obviously you guys probably didn't see this, but he did a one-on-one with, I forget the guy that's really not afraid to just be a complete a-hole.
It was on Big Barstool? Cat, on I Barstool. I did see that.
And he basically, face-to-face with Rodgers, says, my Super Bowl every year as a Bears fan is when you blow it in the playoffs. And he's like, and I literally, he goes, I can't tell. He goes, and he went into detail. He goes, so like when you blew it against the Niners and lost in the playoffs, he goes, I drove from like Philadelphia to New York. He goes, I intentionally put on my radio, the Wisconsin radio stations, and listened to them for an hour and a half just so I could hear them say, blow up Lambeau, and this sucks, and we need a dome because we aren't built for snow. And Rodgers just sat there and took it the whole time, and I was like, man, that was pretty impressive. That dude just laid it out like that.
Yeah, they're pretty funny. They were asking him how many grandmothers he's killed, too, because he's not vaccinated, which was his response.
I didn't see that.
Whatever side you're on, it was a pretty funny response. It was a funny interview, not to be taken seriously at all. 4488 says, Pena and Yordan are really struggling right now. Pena looks lost at the plate. Pena is struggling. I want to talk about Yordan, though. Is there any thought that Yordan's hand is still bothering him?
Now, I had heard Vanessa and Gallant kind of reference that. That's the first that I had heard of it to actually think about it. I didn't think it was anything like that because when he swings, look, I go back to Springer with the axe handle bat, right? When he had that, what do you call it? The Hammett bone?
The Hammett, yeah.
Yeah, when he had the Hammett issue, every so often there was a swing where he would just absolutely writhe in pain and jump out of the batter's box and do all those things. I understand Yordan's a big, tough dude, but there's never even a flinch that looks like there's something going on with the thumb. And you know what? Was it last night that he did get a hit, that he hit a ball to left center?
Yeah, it was first inning.
Yeah.
With two out, nobody on, because that's the spot in the lineup that bats the most often with two outs and none on.
But look, he got a hit there. It's just we've seen it through most of the guys in this lineup that they have a certain point in the year where they go through a downturn. I'm not worried about it. I'm not associating with the thumb. I'm just saying right now, you know, and a lot of times guys are pitching around him too. But I'm not associating with the thumb.
The dude's played more games, I believe, than any other Astro. I think he and Bregman are tied since the All-Star break. So they're obviously not concerned about limiting the at-bats of Yordan Alvarez. They're playing him defensively. I don't think they're worried about Yordan Alvarez's hand at all. I don't think his recent struggles have anything to do with his hand. Also, he's still hitting the ball hard. Like, he's hitting the ball with authority.
Yes.
If he turned into Yuli Gurriel, where the ball was coming off his bat at 75 miles per hour, I would be concerned about the health of the hand. He's taking batting practice. You're not going to allow a player with a busted up hand to take batting practice day in, day out. I don't think it has anything to do with the hand. The one area that I've noticed with Yordan in these recent struggles, and look, it's Yordan Alvarez, he's going to come out of it, and he's one swing away from coming out of it. I feel like he's starting to chase more, and his command at the plate isn't as high as we've seen him when he's at his peak. I just don't think he's in great form. He's swinging and missing at more pitches out of the zone. We saw that really throughout the entire game yesterday. So he's chasing pitches out of the zone, which is something that Yordan never does. His play discipline's fantastic. We're not seeing that lately, and I think it's because he's getting frustrated that his hard hits aren't going for hits. So he's starting to chase more pitches out of the zone. That's what I see. I don't see any semblance of the hand being a bother for Yordan.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know what? The one that got me, that, to your point, was with the runners in scoring position, and he absolutely showed plate on the 2-2 pitch, the plate discipline to lay off.
But the first two, he swung and missed out of the zone.
He flailed badly at the first two. But then I was like, oh, no, he's okay, because that 2-2 pitch, he totally could have bit on it, and he didn't.
It was a good take.
And then you're like, and if you look at Cease's pattern, 3-2, every single time, it was not a strike.
Mm-hmm.
It was a slider that came, looked like it was going to be in the zone, and then was completely out of it. And it was like no one would actually challenge him to basically say, I'm laying off of it no matter what, because he can't throw a strike. And he went and just flailed at a ball in the dirt. And I was like, oh, that's a killer.
That's the difference between struggling Yordan. Yeah, me too. I do too.
Yeah.
To me, that's the difference between struggling Yordan and at form Yordan. And look, I think he's a day away from getting out of it. Once he, like, okay, I'm chasing. I need to stop chasing. I think he'll snap out of it like that. His play discipline right now is just a little bit out of whack, and that's going to happen. over 162. 713-780-ESPN. We didn't get to the tease. Are the Yankees struggles a consolation to the back-to-back rough losses? 713-780-3776. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
To call into the HRNP listener line, dial 713-780-ESPN. Administration of employee benefits is a hassle. Let HRNP eliminate those burdens and save you money. Visit HRP.net today. Your team's our priority. Join the conversation with the Killer Bees. Now coming to you live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Yankees are losing baseball.
Yes.
They've lost back-to-back games. They're on a bit of a... they're reeling right now. Astros have lost back-to-back games. We know that. They've blown a couple of late leads.
Reeling?
Reeling.
I didn't realize how far they're... You know, they haven't won a series in like their last five or six?
Yeah, it's reeling.
No, it's more than reeling. From basically everybody from like the mid, all the way to the mid-season point, seeing if they could set the all-time record for wins in a season. Yeah. Oh, how quickly things change. God, I love it. It's the only thing that's painful about these two losses is that you could have actually really distanced yourself from the Yankees had you gotten these last two games, because they keep peeing down their leg.
Yeah, that's what they're doing, is they lose baseball games right down the pinstripes. Are there struggles, though, a consolation to the Astros' back-to-back rough losses?
Oh, yeah.
The fact that they're losing, you still have some separation in the American League. For those that want the one seed, because like, I don't even really care if you get the one seed, if I'm being perfectly honest. But do you think there's some consolation there, that the pinstripes are peeing down those pinstripe pants as you lost back-to-back games in late innings?
Yeah, look, I think that that is a definite consolation, because you don't even worry about what Seattle's doing anymore. You just know that where you're at. The good thing about this is it's almost a win without a win. Because of the fact that there's like 44 games left in the season, every time that you match them and push them another night, that means it's just another game off the schedule that they can't make up ground on, to where you still have a multiple game lead and you're sitting where you want to sit. So could it have been better? Yes. But would it have been? Could it have been worse? Absolutely. And it's not, because you're not worried about the division and you didn't let the Yankees gain any ground. So you're okay.
Yeah, I think it is a consolation, too. And this is coming from somebody who doesn't even necessarily crave the one seed. To me, it's firmly on the fence. You get the one seed, great. I see the positives of it. Home foot advantage, lock that in. Guarantee four games at Minute Maid Park in a seven-game series if you're playing the Yankees. Fantastic. If you get the two seed, I'm not scared of going into Williamsport at Yankee Stadium and beating the Yankees. The Astros have shown that they can go in there and they can beat up on the Yankees. They split a four-game series there in the regular season, and the two games they lost, they should have won. And then you can sell me the bill of goods that the 4-5 is an easier opponent than the 3-6. So, like, I hate doing whatever radio, but that's kind of how I feel about the one seed. But I also do see that if you do have the one seed as a goal, as an aspiration, as a feather in the cap, yeah, look, the Astros, best team in the American League. Yeah, there is consolation to watching the Yankees, scoreboard watching. When you lose, well, you're not losing any ground because they lost too. So there's some consolation there, but there's also the frustration, as you said, that, hey, look, you know, you're not keeping your foot on the gas. Yankees are losing. You could separate yourself at the top of the American League. Forget about it. They're 2.5 up right now. You've had a chance to be at 4.5 if you keep a couple of late leads. But overall, I think it is a good thing. When you lose, Yankees are lose, you're not really losing anything in the race.
Yeah, no, that's why I felt a lot better about it, because with you out yesterday, you didn't realize how I had a hard time sleeping again.
Because you just didn't want to do the show without me?
No, because of the loss on the Urquidy start.
Oh.
Because it bothered me that much. That this is much like the Yankee series with the result you didn't want, right? You were dominant and winning the majority of both these first two games.
Uh-huh.
And then to have it end the way it ended with all the variables that you could actually point fingers at on Monday night, that was hard. That was a hard pill to swallow for me. Last night, like you said, I'm okay with it, because it's Verlander relying on his stuff to try and finish the deal that he started, and it just didn't work out. But it was a little easier to accept, and especially when I checked the scoreboard immediately after the game to find out that the Yankees had lost, I was like, okay, now I'm a little better with it, because it's not damaging to where they sit within the American League.
Yeah, 713-780-ESPN, Astros blowing back-to-back games. Any consolation for you with the Astros losing two that the Yankees are also losing at the same time? That way you can be the top seed in the American League. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Three, Austin saying felt like the Sox fans are the, not the fans, the Sox, the White Sox, were laying off some pitches. Maybe they picked something up on Verlander, and with men on base, the new signals were getting crossed, so they were trying to get the new signals right. That, I don't believe that was the conversation with Maldonado and Verlander. You could tell that it was scouting report. Yeah. Justin Verlander actually said after the game, we played the clip earlier, that it was about the scouting report. They didn't have the mannerisms and the actions of somebody being on their signs, and they used PitchCom.
Right, yeah.
So I don't think the signs had anything to do with it.
And Maldi's little remote control for PitchCom is all over the place anyway.
Yeah, but he uses it between his legs now.
And sometimes when he goes to chase a foul ball or whatever, and it ends up like halfway between home and first, and someone's always got like a tracker on that thing to find it and give it back to him. The umpires are always giving it back to him. But yeah, no, he knows where that thing is, and they don't have an issue with that. It was definitely, if it was going to be a non-issue about the scouting report, it would be what it was.
I enjoyed the heck out of that mound visit. I really did.
Well, it's shocking because you normally hate mound visits.
Look, I mean this sincerely. Like, the fact that you have one of the greatest pitchers of all time having an animated, loud conversation with Martin Maldonado, a dude that's not hitting above the Mendoza line, and that Verlander's given Maldonado all the respect in the world, Maldonado not at all backing down from one of the greatest pitchers of our generation. Then you have a first-year pitching coach coming out to the mound and looked like he was kind of lecturing Justin Verlander. Like, I thought that there was tons of entertainment there. The only thing that was missing, Blankers, in that mound visit was Carlos Correa. That's the only thing that could have made it better.
Well, but you know what? And I'm not going to say that it was completely staged, but I think from Miller's point of view, it was saving face a little bit. Because he was so thoroughly, literally, that was embarrassing what Verlander did to him the last time.
That's Verlander. You got to wear it.
You're supposed to, but at the same time, you're a new pitching coach taking over for Brent Strom, and everybody kind of came away from that looking like, oh, you're Justin's bitch.
All right, Justin, this is how we're going to handle it. Yeah. Okay, head back to the dugout.
Turn your ass around and get back to the dugout, old fella. So the fact that he came out doing that,
I think Verlander might be older.
I don't think so. But the fact that whether it was part of it or not, at least it kind of save face a little bit and send the message that he's, you know, he still has some authority in the dugout. So, I don't know if that was part of it or not, but I like the fact that at least he got right in the middle of it and just kind of said what he had to say.
Yeah, I like that too. I got a kick out of that. More of a kick out of that than I should have. 4488, I think we'll see more intentional box when Astros have a man on second like last night. I think it's funny how paranoid teams are still that the Astros are stealing signs. Now, Chris Woodward did this in that extra inning game when they had a 5-run lead and Bregman was the automatic runner at second base, and then they had the intentional balk. They didn't want Bregman there picking up locations with a stinking 5-run lead.
I mean,
he's been fired since.
Yeah.
Chris Woodward has.
And so now we're doing it again.
Yeah, last night, Dylan Cease, so it must have been the first 5 innings. I can't remember what inning it was. Bregman's at second base. It must have been after the RBI double.
Yeah.
Bregman going the other way over the head of Andrew Vaughn, scoring, was it Yuli? It must have been Yuli, after Jose Altuve was picked off. The intentional balk. I'm sitting there watching the game. I'm like, okay, Cease is on the rubber. He just dropped the baseball. That's a balk. They didn't call it. Dylan Cease was arguing against himself. He's like, hey, guys, I'm on the rubber. I just dropped the baseball. That's a balk. Are you going to call it? And they finally did.
It's becoming a thing. And I don't, you know what, as much as because, and it'll probably at some point, there'll be some outlet that's going to make a really big deal of this. But again, as part of, this is why the casuals don't understand. Forever and a day, people have been doing all these different things in baseball. And it's right there. Like, if you're not hiding, there's a reason why the catcher always looks up to see if the hitter's looking at him and then doesn't move to where he actually wants the pitch till actually when the pitcher starts his delivery to the plate, because of the fact that if you're going to make it so obvious to everyone, except for the fact that the hitter's back to you, back is turned to you, but your guy on second base can let you know, hey, by the way, guard the inside part of the plate, that's where he's throwing, that's on you.
Yeah, to me, like, there's PitchCom. Like, why are you? You can only be worried about location. And if you're worried about location.
And that's what he's been shipping, evidently.
Yeah, that, like you said, though, that's on you.
Yeah.
Like, that's how you receive a ball if you're a catcher. That's poor receiving if you're a catcher. I don't think it's very good strategy either. Like, I understand two outs, you're probably scoring on a base hit no matter what. But those 90 feet, while they're not huge with two outs, they matter. All of a sudden, you score on a wild pitch, you score on a pass ball, you score on an infield error where you probably wouldn't score from second base on an infield error. There's more ways to score. I don't understand the value of doing it. In fact, I think it's stupid that teams are doing it. Like, work on how you're receiving. And I think it's borderline Bush League, if I'm being completely honest with you. Like, you're doing that, and you're telling the Houston Astros, and literally everybody in the world while you're doing it, you're saying that the Astros are trying to pick, that they're doing something that is Bush League. So you're drawing attention, and you're highlighting the fact that Bregman's at second base. You're saying to the entire world that Bregman's trying to pick up on things, which isn't illegal, by the way. And because to counter that, we're going to go ahead and just give him a free 90 feet. I think it's borderline Bush League, if I'm being completely honest with you.
I think it's actually a little bit stupid.
Oh, because, I think it absolutely
you know, you
stupid.
Throw a wild pitch or you get a ball that just no matter how good your catcher is back there, that it, you know if you don't block a pitch and suddenly you're giving up a run because you're a little bit hyper scared of what Bregman's doing at second base, it's totally on you, but it is. It's a bad look.
Yeah. Remember Bregman doubled in the first inning?
Yep.
And then Kyle Tucker doubled as well?
Yep.
Or was that it was first inning. Maybe that had something to do with it. Maybe it was like, Kyle Tucker must have. It was actually a pretty good breaking ball that he did.
Maybe
that
it was
too.
Just Dr. Dre motivating both players.
What's he calling Tucker these days?
Well, he used to be Wet Blanket. But
you
I, call
Tucker
I don't know
Wet
he,
Blanket?
I don't think he's eased up on that, or maybe he's eased up a little bit. But he's been on Bregman all year.
Man, yeah. Bregman's been on fire, and he's still on Bregman.
Yep.
Yeah, he calls him Buzzkill. Buzzkill's motivated him. 713-780-ESPN. How do you feel about that? Those intentional balks that teams are deploying against the Houston Astros? 713-780-3776. Got a question for you. Can young quarterbacks turn things around the same way that Peyton Manning did? Or is that antiquated? Is that antiquated logic? It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Hey, before we go to the break, tell you about the good people at Fitz Roofing. Look, I was talking to Corey this morning. If you don't know, Corey not only runs the business, but he's also the vice president of the Houston Roofing Association. He knows roofing, and he knows what to do to help you. Simply put, he likes taking care of Houstonians, and that means he has the best warranties in the business. They use the best products in the business, starting with CertainTeed shingles. They're so much so that they're a CertainTeed Select Shingle Master company. Only 1% of the roofers in the United States have the credibility and have done the right things to get that kind of award and be anointed. They have it for you. Their ratings in the business are better than anybody else. If you check it up on Facebook and Home Advisor, they're getting about a 4.9 on a scale to 5. Everybody knows that if you need something done with your roofing, you go to Fitz Roofing. And the fact is, what people don't know is they also do home repairs, too. They put a fence in my yard 2 months ago. It looks fantastic. Check them out today and all the services that they can offer to help you. FITZRoofing.com. And then when you're ready, or if you just need them to see what they can do to help you, call them, 832-521-3001. Unlike other companies that charge a service fee just to come out and see what you got going on, they come to you for free. Free, no obligation inspection today. That means they'll come and see what you got going on, don't charge you a penny, and tell you how they can help. That is a bonus. Check them out today. Call them, 832-521-3001. Fitz Roofing, making a difference, one home at a time.
ESPN 97.5. Independent thinking, unrestricted opinions. You're tuned in to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
We'll get into the can second-year quarterbacks turn it around. A la Peyton Manning in 3 minutes. We wouldn't normally do this, but Graham's on the line, 713-780-ESPN. And he wants to talk about Trey Mancini. So if he wants to talk about Mancini, we always have time for our Mancini
you know
Press
I
Monday.
Do.
Yeah. So let's go out to the HRP listener line. Graham, you're in the Hive. You got a question about Mancini?
Yeah. I mean, this call was specifically for Joel because I know he said the other day that he always checks if it's a Mancini day. Yesterday was not a Mancini day. you know, a big thing I think about is he has a player option at the end of the year. He's a really good player, and Brantley's out for the year, so why aren't we playing him?
Well, it's a great question, Graham, because I have instituted hashtag play the man because of the fact that he was only playing 50% of the time. I have made mention of the fact that both Trey and Vasquez are guys that either are going to be free agencies, a free agent in the case of Vasquez, or could opt out in the case of Mancini. So if you want to have any chance of bringing them back, and Jeremy has a differing opinion about whether either guy would either come back or would be interested in it, I would just like to leave the door open by making sure that they are a perfect fit for this team. And now when you factor in that last night, Aledmys Diaz hurt his groin, turning and trying to catch a ball in left field. There's even more that should be just pounding Dusty Baker's brain cells going, you need to play Trey, period.
Need to play Trey. Why did you go groin?
Groin.
Why did you do that?
Because it's an uncomfortable area.
I love the groin. I love groin. The Pink Panther. We're talking about Mancini.
That's right.
Yeah, mutual option for next season. So the Astro, it takes two to tango on a mutual option. I have three pipe dreams for the first base job next year for the Astros. Mancini is one of them. I don't believe Yuli Gurriel will be on this team. The only scenario,
if he's not, then Mancini should better be.
The only scenario I see Yuli on this team is as a backup corner infielder, and him at 39 playing third base. Don't know if I love that. I don't think Gurriel is on this team next year. I 100% don't think he's on this team as the everyday first baseman. So three, if you go in free agency, there's three dudes that I absolutely love. Trey Mancini's one of them. My Mancini crush Monday. The second one is the guy that everybody thought the Astros were going to trade
Bell's
for.
Free
is Josh
agent.
Bell.
He can just come here.
The third one is one that we've seen up close and personal the last couple of days. Jose Abreu is a free agent at the end of the year.
And he's tight with Altuve.
The Cuban influence. Well, Altuve's not Cuban, no, but he is tight with Altuve.
But they are tight.
He's tight with Yuli, too, which is kind of counterproductive here. But he's hitting over 300. His power numbers aren't there this year as they have been in the past. And he is in his mid-30s, so that's a little bit of a concern. So short-term, not long-term, obviously. But Jose Abreu in this lineup, any one of those three in this lineup. It's funny that you have one and you want hashtag play the man. But that's my pipe dream first baseman next year is Mancini, Bell, or Abreu.
And I'm with you on all three. And when you look at a guy like Abreu, if you want to question him, you look at a guy that had multiple hits against Verlander last night that's hitting over 300 against Verlander last night.
People don't realize his bat-to-ball skills.
He hits good pitching. Mm-hmm. He is a good hitter.
Good contact guy.
So you don't have to go and load him up for, like, you know, 7 to 10 years.
2 years.
But he probably wants to play on a winning team, too, because the White Sox, as much as even this year, they were favored to do it and they didn't do it. This is the kind of situation for, you know, to be a part of a winner that he knows is going to go to the playoffs and he's going to play with guys he likes to be around. I think it's an ideal situation. Just like you didn't have to give up anything for Josh Bell. And you still have a chance to get him this offseason and add him when you really need him, which is next year. My prediction for next year is that Yuli Gurriel is going to be a Toronto Blue Jay playing with his brother for at least a year so that they can fade into the sunset together. He can fade
Blue Jays
into the
have to
together.
Be a willing party on that, though.
I think they would be, though.
Maybe. Maybe. We'll see. I don't think he's going to be an Astro, though. Give me one of those three. I'd be happy about it. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. And the question we have for you, Hive, can young quarterbacks turn things around from rookie year to sophomore year like Peyton Manning did? Like Peyton Manning? Or is that an outdated reference? What was able to, like, where this conversation was born from? Peter King had a conversation with his favorite long neck quarterback in the NFL, Davis Mills. And Davis Mills told Peter King, didn't Peyton set the rookie interception record? I got to play, then watch and learn, then play in my first year, and I thought I had a lot of growth by the end. This isn't so much the Davis Mills conversation. This is more about rookie quarterbacks. Can a rookie quarterback, a la Peyton Manning, have just an absolute disaster of a rookie season? I think we saw disasters in a rookie season last year from Zach Wilson. I thought that was overall a disaster. He flashed, but overall a disaster. I thought Trevor Lawrence was an overall disaster, flashed, but a disaster. And then you had the Urban Meyer, he played a part in that. He was very much a piece of that variable. But do you think a rookie quarterback can have that kind of turnaround where you look like a debacle in your rookie season, and then your sophomore season, you're sensational?
I don't think sensational. I don't think because of the way the game has evolved to be so pass happy and you have to be so precise and do so many things like well on a consistent basis. I don't think sensational, but I think that you can have a really good season. I think that in year two, when you start figuring out defenses,
let me
more,
phrase the question differently.
All right.
Can you go from being bad in a rookie season? Peyton Manning was bad in his rookie season. To turning it around, being a good quarterback.
So. I think you can. I do. I think you can. I think a lot of it has to do with all the variables around you from the coaching and the offensive system you're running. And again, I'll make reference in this case to the Chicago Bears. But if you're going to take a guy that has unbelievable running skills, that is athletic as all get out, and you're going to make him sit in the pocket like they did with Fields and call plays that just either get his head ripped off or force him to hand the ball off or do things that he wasn't ready to do yet, then that's on you. But if you've got the offensive system and like-minded coaches and you are, you know, a student of the game enough to do the homework to improve on the things that you need to do and have a grasp of, I think you absolutely can go from however you want to say his first year went to a good quarterback in this league.
I think the same thing. I think that a quarterback in their rookie year, you want to see more flashes than the overall body of work. So, like, Zach Wilson, you look at his first year, it wasn't good. But I saw some flashes there where I'm like, Zach Wilson's got a chance to be a good football player.
Yep.
Same thing with Trevor Lawrence. Trevor Lawrence, look, that whole situation was a disaster. There were still times, even in that disaster, in that dumpster fire that was the Jacksonville Jaguars, where I'm looking at Trevor Lawrence, I'm like, man, that guy's got some – he's got every throw in his bag. That guy can play. That guy has a shot. I can't wait to see what Trevor Lawrence looks like with Doug Peterson.
I'm anxious to see it because I didn't see what you saw. I mean, there was a throw here or there, but overall, I thought it was a massive disappointment. Look, I know he was up against it because of who his coach was and because of the entire debacle that was Urban Meyer's stint with the Jags. But I think that, now that you've got a quarterback whisperer, a really good offensive-minded coach, a Super Bowl champion, a guy that knows how to handle quarterbacks, it should be interesting. I think you're going to find out real quick who Trevor Lawrence really is and what he can be in this league. I think that when you look at some of the success stories to be able to do those things, you look at a guy like Lamar Jackson. Look, he was going to take his lumps in the first year.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? The Ravens were smart. They had the right coaching staff around him. They completely redid their playbook to basically excel because of his strengths and not force him to do things that were weaknesses. And in year two, he took off. And I think those are the kind of possibilities that are out there if you are capable of adjusting and learning on the fly the things that you didn't do well in the first year.
The example that I used that was my pushback to this, and Brendan gave it right back to me. He said, you're an idiot. I have pushback for you. I said, what was Pat Mahomes as a rookie? Pat Mahomes was a literal nothing as a rookie. And Brendan said, well, that's not 30 interceptions. He didn't play. Yeah. Who's to say Pat Mahomes wasn't going to be Pat Mahomes if he would have just gotten on the football field his rookie year? Like, I told Brendan, look, Pat Mahomes in the offseason between year one and year two, he was Trey Lance. We knew nothing about Pat Mahomes, just like we know nothing about Trey Lance. And Trey Lance was, what, the third pick of the NFL draft, whereas Pat Mahomes was the 10th pick of the NFL draft? So I really don't put a whole lot of stock, to be honest with you, in a rookie year. Like, you could look, I think you can see more about, like, okay, does this guy have the throws? Does this guy look like an NFL player than you can by looking at the stats like Peyton Manning's 30 interceptions?
I would never write off the ability for a guy to grow from year one to year two. I don't think in today's NFL, if you are a guy with superstar potential like Peyton Manning was, that you are ever going to throw 30 interceptions. Or even, I mean, the league's changed. You're not going to throw 20 interceptions if you're a Peyton Manning in your rookie year.
See, I disagree with that. I disagree with that.
I can't think of a great example. Like, I was trying to think of a guy who was terrible in his rookie year.
Aikman, his first year, got the crap beat out of him, and they didn't win a game.
But that would be antiquated, though.
I'm trying to think of the last...
If Manning's antiquated, then Aikman would be antiquated.
I'm trying to think of the last 10 years. And a guy who came to mind for me was Jared Goff. But do we think Jared Goff is good?
Nope.
He got to a Super Bowl.
Do we think he's good, or do we think that a coach helped him get to a level that maybe wasn't realistic?
Probably more the latter.
And like, he didn't throw many interceptions, but he was not good his rookie year. He was a guy that people thought the Rams were going to have to move on from. I can't think of a lot of examples of guys who were terrible. Like, in today's NFL, as a quarterback, the league is so quarterback-friendly. If you're going to be a superstar, you're going to be at least okay as a rookie. For that reason, I'm kind of out on Trevor Lawrence as a superstar, too.
I'm trying to think of what... Like, Josh Allen wasn't very good as a rookie at all.
No, Josh Allen is a good example.
Like, Josh Allen's
a really good example.
He would be the answer to this. Because if you're looking at just top five quarterbacks right now, Aaron Rodgers didn't play. So, like, if we're using... And he's also older. So, like, he might even be too antiquated whenever he was a rookie. Same thing with Brady. Too old, too antiquated. But if you're looking at top five quarterbacks, Pat Mahomes didn't play, so you have to rule him out. It is interesting, though. You're looking at the top five quarterbacks, who didn't play their rookie year. It's almost all of them.
Talk about Josh Allen being an anomaly. That's the one, because you're right, Josh Allen's a great example.
Yeah, because they were really, critics were really hard on the Bills after his first year.
He had more interceptions than touchdowns. Now, he didn't throw 30.
He didn't throw 30,
but he wasn't throwing it much. And, like, that was also the confidence, too. And, like, see, like, if you have a Peyton Manning, if you're allowing a quarterback, a rookie quarterback, to go out and play every single snap and give him the freedom to throw 30 interceptions, that, to me, tells you they believe in the guy. That, to me, tells you that they think he's going to be a superstar at some point, and you're allowing to play through the struggles. So, yeah, I think you can see a tremendous amount of growth from a quarterback who was not good as a rookie turn it around. And I think Josh Allen would be the answer.
Jeremy thinks Davis Mills is going to be a superstar. Book it.
No, it's not every quarterback.
I'm kidding.
Not every quarterback. Well, I like Davis Mills.
I think he thinks Trevor Lawrence
is going
to be.
I like Dougie Mills.
I'm not sold.
I do. I have stock on the Jags and Trevor Lawrence.
I am not sold on Trevor Lawrence after year one. And look, I might even say I hope he proves me wrong. I don't wish bad on anybody. But I did not see a guy that, and again, because of those variables with the coaching staff, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. But as a number one overall pick in the draft, I expected a lot more out of Trevor Lawrence in year one.
You should have. You should. You, if a number one pick of the NFL draft should play better than Trevor Lawrence played in his first year. I feel like there's other circumstances that happen there that are beyond his control that influence that. Look, I have a futures ticket on Jacksonville. It's my long shot dark horse. I don't think they're going to finish in first. I think that the chances of them finishing in first is better than Vegas thinks, though. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Do you think young quarterbacks can turn it around the same way that Peyton Manning did, or is that antiquated? Also, who is the most pivotal rookie for Texans' success in 2022? It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Who's this?
Hey, this is Trey Wingo. You're listening to ESPN 97.5 Houston. Hello.